You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 216 by Rudolf Steiner, 8 lectures, translated by Paul King, entitled Supersensible Impulses in the Historical Development of Humanity. This is Lecture 7, given in Dornach on the 30th of September, 1922. We have seen how the fundamental impulses of human history come to expression in phenomena such as the curious inclination of Egyptian civilization to mummify the human form, and in more recent times, in the conservation of ancient cultic forms, which also represent a mummification in a certain respect, but a mummification of cultural practices. When we look back once more with certain ideas to Egyptian civilization and its external manifestation in mummification, we need to connect what we see there with what was said in the course I recently gave over in the Goetheanum building, but which I have given on several occasions here. I am referring to the discussion on the normal activity of thinking in human beings, how they gradually develop this during childhood, attain a certain proficiency in it, and then continue with it between their youth and their death. We've got to know this thought activity, this intellectual functioning, as I have often called it, as a kind of inner soul corpse. We have repeatedly brought to mind that thinking as exercised by people in earthly life is only seen in the right light when we regard it as having the same relation to our actual being as a corpse has to the living earthly person who has left it behind after passing through the portal of death. That which makes a human being actually leaves. And what remains in the corpse is something that can only have the form we see because it has been left behind by a living person. No one could be so naive as to believe that the form of the human corpse could arise just by some kind of combination of forces. It has to be the result of something. Something must have preceded it. A living person must have preceded it. External nature, which we study, certainly has the power to destroy the form of a human corpse, but it does not have the power to create it. The human form is created by the higher members of being that human beings possess. But at death, these depart. In the same way as we see that a corpse comes from a living person, so we see that thinking, when we perceive it correctly, cannot through itself be what it is in earthly life, but that it is a corpse of the soul. It is the corpse of what it was before the human being descended from soul spiritual worlds into earthly existence. The soul was something in its pre-earthly existence which died, as it were, at birth. And the corpse of this soul element that died is thinking. And how could it be otherwise, since the individuals who best understood how to live with thinking felt this deadness, this state in abstract thinking of having died? I need only remind you of the gripping place at which Nietzsche begins his description of philosophy in the tragic age of the Greeks, where he describes how in the pre-Socratic philosophers like Parmenides or Heraclitus, the Greek world of thought rose to abstract thought concerning our genesis and existence. There, so Nietzsche says, one feels an icy chill come over one. And indeed, that is how it is. Just compare how the people of the ancient Orient sought to understand external nature, in living, inwardly active, albeit more dreamlike soul pictures. In contrast to this active thinking, whose flowering we find in Vedanta philosophy and in the Vedas, in contrast to this active thinking that is everywhere burgeoning and sprouting and weaving through the whole human being in a living way, What emerged later as abstract thought is indeed a dead corpse. Nietzsche sensed this when he felt impelled to describe the pre-Socratic philosophers, who were the first in human evolution to ascend to such abstract thoughts. But consider the Oriental sages who preceded the Greek philosophers. You find in them not the slightest doubt that human beings have a soul existence before they come down to earth. One can't experience thinking as something living and not, at the same time, believe in the pre-existence of human beings. Someone who experiences living thinking is like one who on earth sees living human beings. A person who no longer experiences thinking as something alive, as the Greek philosophers did even before Socrates, can think like Aristotle, that the human being is a being born only at birth. So we need to make a distinction between the former Oriental, inwardly active and living thinking, whereby one knew that one had entered earthly existence from spiritual worlds, and then the dead thinking, the corpse thinking that emerged, by which people learn nothing other than what is accessible to us between birth and death. Put yourself in the position of such a person in Egypt, let's say in the second millennium before the mystery of Golgotha. They would have to say to themselves, over there in the East, there were once people who had a thinking that was living. But this Egyptian sage was still in a peculiar situation. He did not yet have the soul life that we have today. Try to imagine, as vividly as you can, what the soul life of such an Egyptian sage was like. The sense of a living thinking was already gone from the soul. People were no longer able to have this, but abstract thinking had not yet emerged. A substitute was created by embalming mummies, through which, in the way I described, one came to an idea, a notion of the human form. One trained oneself toward a comprehension of this human form using the mummy. And by this means, people first acquired a thinking that was abstract and dead. In contrast to this is the fact, as I described yesterday, that in more modern times, in certain occult associations, rituals, cultic forms, ceremonial acts have been preserved, which once existed in a living way in humanity, but are now preserved as something dead. You only need recall what you have perhaps read about the rituals of the Masonic order. You find there that ceremonies have been developed for the first degree, the second degree, and third degree. These ceremonies are learned, described, and even performed in an external way. This was once a process full of life. People once lived in it how the plant lives in its life principle. Today they have become a dead thing. With the exception of just a few individual priestly natures, even the mystery of Golgotha has not been able to arouse the inner aliveness associated with the church rituals that have developed since the mystery of Golgotha. But until now, humanity has not been able to bring a fully living quality into the cultic element. For this, something else is needed. All the present-day thinking of humanity is actually directed toward what is dead. For the time being, there is no understanding at all for the living thinking that once existed. The intellectualistic thinking humanity has practiced since the middle of the 14th century is a corpse. This is why this thinking is so determined to restrict itself to what is dead in nature, to investigating the mineral kingdom. And people would like to study plants, animals, man himself, only according to mineral, physical, and chemical forces. Because people only want to deal with this dead thinking, with this thought corpse, that purely intellectualistic human beings drag around with themselves. I have already mentioned Goethe in this series of lectures. As you know, Goethe was a Freemason. He experienced Masonic ritual, but experienced it in a way that only Goethe could. For him, immediate life emanated from the cultic forms that were otherwise simply a matter of preserved tradition. Being able to come into contact with that spiritual entity that entered into the ritual in the way I described, from pre-earthly existence into this earthly existence, was a reality for him. For Goethe, this was always a kind of rejuvenating power. For Goethe had really often undergone a rejuvenation process in the course of his life. And from this inner life, there emerged from Goethe what is fundamentally one of the greatest, one of the most significant phenomena of the modern life of thought, but which, even up to today, is not appreciated. This is the idea of metamorphosis. What had Goethe really done by grasping the idea of metamorphosis? What this was the lighting up once more of an inwardly living thinking, of a thinking that can enter the cosmos. Goethe had rejected Linnaean botany, where one sets one plant next to the other, gets an idea of each individual plant, and then tries to put it all into a nice system. Goethe couldn't go along with this. Goethe did not want to have just these dead concepts. He wanted to have a living thinking. He achieved this firstly by looking at the plant itself. The way he saw it, the plant was such that, low down, it grew rather crude, unformed leaves. A little higher, it grew formed leaves, which, however, were transformations, metamorphoses of the other leaves. Then, still higher, it formed petals with a different color, then stamens, and in the middle the pistil. All these were transformations of a basic leaf form. Goethe's way of looking at a leaf was not such that he said, this is one leaf and that is another leaf. Goethe did not look in this way at what was growing on the plant, but he said, the fact that this leaf looks like this and that leaf looks like that is an externality. Seen from within, the leaf itself has an inner power of transformation so that it can just as well look one way as another. It is not two leaves at all, it is one leaf, represented in two different ways. And when Goethe looked at the leaf, there's a drawing, he said, the green leaf is below, the petal is above. The intellectualistic Philistine says these are two, that they are two leaves. What could be more obvious for an intellectualistic Philistine than that these are two leaves? For one is even red and the other green. And if a person has a green coat and a red jacket, these are certainly two things, for Philistinism, in modern times at least, is applicable to clothing. There, Philistinism is at home. But the plant does not partake in Philistinism. Goethe said to himself, the red petal is the same as the green leaf. It is not two leaves at all. It is actually one leaf in different configurations. In one situation, the same force works below at A, see drawing. Here, it works primarily such that the forces are drawn out of the earth. The plant pulls forces from the earth, draws them upward, and the leaf, obliged to grow under the influence of earth forces, turns green. As the plant continues to grow, the sun is there and shines more strongly than farther down. The sun gains the upper hand. The same impulse grows into the sun and becomes red. Goethe might have said roughly the following. When someone who has nothing to eat sees someone else eating an enormous amount, they turn pale with envy. In another situation, someone gives them a shove and they turn red. Following the same principle that says these are two leaves, one could also say that this is two people. One is pale and the other is red, so it is two people. It is no more two leaves than it is two people. It is one leaf. At one time it is one thing, at another place it is another. And for Goethe this was not something to wonder at particularly, since after all a person can run from one spot to another without its being two people that we see in different places. In short, Goethe realized that the way of looking at things simply in juxtaposition is not truth, but an illusion. That it is one leaf, green here and red there. But he looked at different plants in the same way as he looked at the different organs of the plant. Let's look at it like this. Here we have a plant of some kind, Steiner draws. It is in a good position. It can form a proper root out of the germ, a stem, proper leaves on the stem, a proper flower, and stamens around a pistil. Goethe said, the stamens are also the same leaf. He might have said, yes, an intellectualist would argue that the petals are wide, whereas the stamens are as thin as threads, with just a kind of scar at the top. And yet in the broad petal, and in the very narrow stamen, Goethe still saw only different configurations of one and the same leaf. Figuratively, he might have said, have you ever seen a person who was thin as a reed at one time in their life and later expanded to become quite fat? That isn't two people either. So petal and stamen are one. The fact that they occur in different places is not important and was not the essential point for Goethe. A human being who cannot run so fast cannot be in two places at once. An educated banker in Berlin who was having vociferous demands made on him from all sides once said, do you think I'm a bird, that I can be in two places at once? Well, of course a person cannot do this. But the point here is that Goethe sought everywhere for the principle of metamorphosis, for the display of unity in plurality, of unity in diversity. Through this, Goethe then called to life the idea of metamorphosis. When you grasp what I have said, you get an idea of what spirit is. Just think of everything I have just said. The fact that the whole plant is actually one leaf, shaped in different ways, is certainly not something that can be grasped bodily, that is, outwardly. Here you must grasp something mentally that changes in the most varied ways. It is spirit that is living in the plant kingdom. And we can go further. We can take a plant, as we mentioned, that is in a good situation, whose seed is planted properly into the soil, that then, at the right time, gets the weak spring sunshine, then the sun of high summer, and then, in turn, forms its seeds in the sun that is growing weaker. But now imagine that the plant is planted in natural conditions that don't give it any time to develop a root, nor a proper stem, nor proper leaves, but everything that otherwise develops in the petals is forced to develop terribly quickly and undefined, because it doesn't have time to develop all these things so quickly. In this situation, it becomes a fungus, a mushroom. Here you have two extremes. A plant that has time to differentiate itself in detail, develops root, stem, leaves, flowers, fruits, everything that's possible. But in a plant that is in natural conditions that don't allow it time to form a root, everything is only suggested. Stem and leaves can also not develop, and what is in the flowering principle and fruit formation has to be done quickly and indistinctly. The plant is almost not in the soil and develops in a terrible rush what other plants develop slowly. Think of a corn poppy. First it slowly develops green leaves, then it can slowly and carefully form the red poppy petals, then stamens, then the coquettish pistil at the center of the poppy flower. In a mushroom, this has to be done quickly and over hastily. There isn't time to differentiate, isn't time to be exposed to the sun that could color it. In short, it becomes a mushroom. In mushrooms, we have a very undefined, quick, and over-hastily jotted-down design of a flower. But again, we have one thing. Two very different plants are actually one and the same. But in order really to think all this, one has to become inwardly a bit different. The intellectualist, Goethe would perhaps have said, quote, a rigid Philistine, close quote, looks at a sap-filled red poppy with its plump, well-developed pistil at its center, and then he's required to look at a mushroom. At the same time, he's supposed to keep the concept he'd formed of the poppy so mobile in his mind that it can become indistinct. And he is supposed to see in the poppy itself the predisposition for a chanterelle mushroom or a royal agaric. Well, he can't really manage it. In order that his intellect doesn't have to move, so that he doesn't have to make his mind mobile, but at most only has to shuffle his head along a bit, he must be shown an actual chanterelle or royal agaric. Then he can imagine it side by side with the poppy. Then he manages it. And this is the difference between dead thinking and the inwardly alive, living thinking that Goethe developed for Metamorphosis. It was an inner discovery of the greatest order that came into the world through Goethe. This is why in the introduction I wrote to the first volume of titled Goethe's Scientific Works, which I edited at the beginning of the 80s of the previous century, I wrote the sentence, "Goethe is simultaneously the Copernicus and the Kepler of organic science." What Copernicus and Kepler did for external inorganic nature by purifying their ideas in order to grasp astronomy and physics in purified concepts, Goethe achieved for organic science through the living idea, the idea of metamorphosis. This is his central discovery. And if we want, we can find that this idea of metamorphosis extends over all of nature. Once he had got the idea of metamorphosis for plant forms, Goethe naturally immediately began to think that it must be applicable to the animal as well. But things here are harder. Goethe had managed very well in his thought to get one leaf to arise from the other. But how we are to think, let's say, of a vertebra in the spine, metamorphosed in its form into a skull bone, thus allowing us to apply the metamorphosis idea also to animal and man, is much harder. And yet Goethe managed it, as I have often related. When he was on the Venice Lido in 1790 and had the good fortune to come across a sheep's skull that had fallen apart in a particularly favorable way. It was a sheep's skull that had fallen apart into its separate bones. And he suddenly realized that even though very transformed, they did indeed look like the vertebra of the spine. And he developed the thought that the bones at least can be imagined such that they all actually represent one bone impulse, which, however, shows itself in various forms. But Goethe did not get very far with respect to the whole human being, because he did not manage to progress from his idea of metamorphosis to real imagination. But if we attain to real imagination, and from there to inspiration and intuition, unity presents itself to us far more significantly. And I have been able to indicate how this unity in the human being shows itself when we grasp the metamorphosis idea properly. We must begin from the same point of view that Goethe had for the flower of dicotyledons, in which, by thinking more and more simply, more and more nebulously, he saw the mushroom, and study the human head as we find it today. And then we can think of the head as a metamorphosis of the rest of the skeleton. Try to look with an artistic eye, EYE, at one side of the human jawbone. If you look at it with an artistic eye in the way it is inserted here, bracket, Steiner is presumably pointing here to his own jaw, close bracket, and then runs downward to the chin, you will hardly be able not to compare it with the arm or leg bones. If you think of the arm and leg bones transformed, then here in the jaw you also have two legs, but stunted. The head is a lazy fellow who never walks, always just sits. And so it sits on its two legs that are in a state of decadence, are stunted. But if we imagine, for example, the human being with legs tied together, then we can almost imitate what we have here in the jaw. And if we look at this with an artistic eye, it is indeed possible to think how one might get the legs to a point where they were immobile like the jaw. But we only see matters how they really are when we regard the human head as the transformation of another human body. I have shown you that the human head we carry in our current earthly life is the transformation of the body we had in our previous earthly life, minus the previous head. The head of that time is lost to us. Parenthesis, some people might even lose their head during life. Close parenthesis. But in any case, the head forces are lost after our earthly life. Our present head does not contain these. Naturally, I'm talking about forces, not substance. But the forces you now carry in your head are those you had, if you imagine yourself decapitated, in the rest of your body. And the head you had in your previous earthly life originated in turn from the life you had had prior to that. And the body you have now will really be metamorphosed, transformed, and you will bear it as your head in your next earthly life. That's where it comes from. Consider a human embryo in the mother's body. The first thing to appear is the head, to which everything else, as a new formation, is attached. But the head is derived from the previous earthly life, is transformed body, is form, is carried through the whole of life between death and a new birth, shapes itself into head, and attaches the other members and limbs to itself. And so we can say, when we bear in mind repeated earthly lives, what we see in the human being is his most recent metamorphosis. In what Goethe discovered at the beginning of the 80s of the 18th century, in the idea of the metamorphosis of the plant, there is to be found what can lead us to a living concept of evolution through the whole animal kingdom to man, and does so such that it also gives us the idea by which we can grasp repeated earthly lives in their form. Through this, Goethe's thinking became inwardly so alive that he partook of the ceremonial element in ritual. There, even though it did not come to full consciousness in him, he had an inkling of how the human being in pre-earthly existence, in a condition purely of soul, bears with him the forces of the bodily skeleton that remain from his previous life, and how this is carried by the human being into this present earthly life, and is configured into the form of the head in the protective shelter of the mother's body. Goethe did not realize this, but he had had an intimation of it, and applied it initially to what was simplest, to plant life. He could do this because his times were not yet sufficiently mature, did not extend as far as they can be extended today, namely to an apprehension of the transformation in the human being, from one earthly life to the other. It is usually said, with some pity, that Goethe developed this theory of metamorphosis because his artistic nature got in the way. Pedants and Philistines say this out of pity. But one who is not a pedant or Philistine must say with enthusiasm that Goethe was able to combine science with art, and precisely because of this arrived at mobile concepts. But, so the Philistine dialectician argues, you can't understand nature like this. According to him, one has to have rigidly logical, strictly logical concepts. But what if nature is an artist? The whole of natural science, which excludes art and only pursues external concepts, could bypass it, as related to me in a conversation I once had with a Munich artist who was a contemporary of the great aesthetician Carriera. He said, quote, in our youth we artists didn't go to Carriera's lectures. If we did happen to go to one, we left saying that he was just an aesthete wallowing in his own enjoyment, close quote. And just as it can happen to an aesthetician that artists call him a wallflower in his own enjoyment, so nature, if she herself were to speak about her secrets, might call the merely logical scientific researcher not even a wallflower in his own enjoyment, but a wallflower in his own misery. Because it is simply the case that nature creates artistically. And we cannot command nature to be something we can comprehend logically. We must comprehend nature as she is. So this is how historical development goes. In the ancient Orient, there were once living thoughts. I have described how, through a transformation, a metamorphosis of the breathing process, these living thoughts were changed into a process of perception. People had to work their way toward these dead thoughts. The Egyptians were not yet able to do this. They trained themselves toward having dead concepts by working on the human being in his dead condition in the mummified body. We are now in the situation where we must awaken thought once more. This can't happen by cultivating old traditional occult forms, but by really living into and even developing further what Goethe grasped as his idea of metamorphosis, the living thought or concept. One who masters living thought, that is, can work with the spiritual in their soul, is also in a position to enliven external human action once more out of the spirit. We will then come to a time when, as I have often mentioned to our anthroposophical friends, people will no longer stand with such indifference busying themselves so materialistically at the laboratory bench or the dissection table, but will have a sense that what nature whispers to them as her secrets are the deeds of the spirit that actively flows through all of nature. So that the laboratory table becomes an altar. For as long as reverence and religious sensibility are absent in our science, for as long as we have a religion that is separate from science and really serves human egoism, for as long as science itself fails to learn to revere what it researches, the way the mystery pupils learn to revere, as I showed in my book titled Christianity is Mystical Fact, for as long as this is the case, we will not attain once more to the ascending forces of humanity. We must again learn to understand all research as a conversation with the spiritual world. Then we will be able to learn from nature what really advances us in our evolution. And then we will undergo, in a reverse sense, what humanity once had to undergo through the process of mummification. Just as the Egyptians took human bodies and embalmed them, so that now, in a way that almost evokes a shudder in us, whole colonies of mummies can be seen in the museums to which Europeans have hauled them, just as people's thinking was rigidified by means of mummies, so it must be reawakened in the future. The ancient Egyptians took human corpses, embalmed them, conserved death. We have to feel how, when we have only abstract and intellectualistic thoughts, we carry in us a soul death. We have to feel that this is a soul mummy. We need to learn to understand what was living in Paracelsus when he took a certain substance from the human organism and called it the mummy. In a small remnant of substance from the human being, he saw the mummy. He didn't need an embalmed corpse in order to see a mummy, since for him a mummy was the sum of the forces that at every moment could bring death to a person if they did not re-enliven themselves during the night. Dead thinking reigns in us. Thinking is the representative of soul death. In our thinking we bear in ourselves a soul mummy. It comprises precisely what we value the most in our present civilization. If we want, we can go into the museums where mummies are displayed one after the other, and if we are equipped with a somewhat more universal gaze, with a Goethean gaze, for example, we can see metamorphoses. We can walk through the rooms and then go out onto the street with the feeling that in the present age of intellectualism, there is no difference. For the fact that mummies don't walk and that out on the street people are walking along is just a coincidence, is just an externality. The people walking in the street in this intellectual age are mummies, soul mummies, because they are filled with totally dead intellectual thoughts, with thoughts that cannot live. Just as what was originally alive is frozen in the Egyptian mummy, so our soul life is frozen and must be brought to life again for the future of humanity. We cannot continue to approach anatomy and physiology in the way we do. The Egyptians were permitted to do this with physical human corpses, But we may no longer mummify the abstract soul corpse that we bear in ourselves in intellectualistic thinking. As a rule today, what people want is to embalm thinking so that it becomes thoroughly pedantic and will not admit into itself even the smallest spark of enthusiastic life. When mummies are photographed, we also get a rigid picture. In terms of rigidity, it is difficult to distinguish between the picture of the mummy and the mummy itself. But if you open an academic book today on whatever subject, it is a photograph of the mummified soul. There you have an image of a soul mummy. There the soul is embalmed. We might perhaps doubt this somewhat, since apart from their intellect, which is mummified, people still have other things in them. This is why they run about, because they have all sorts of bodily and other urges. The image of the mummy is not quite so clearly defined there, but it comes out very clearly today in books. We notice the embalming there very strongly. But we have to get away from this embalming. Instead of the embalming that the Egyptians applied to mummies, we need a different ingredient. We need an elixir of life. We need this not in the way many might imagine, as something to perfect the physical body, but as something that makes thoughts alive, that unmummifies them. And once we understand this, we have before our souls a profound and significant historical impulse. Just as through mummification, humanity froze its mental and spiritual culture when people embalmed mummies, so once more, in the course of the individual's education, upbringing, and development, we must permeate what comes mummified into the world in the human mind with a soul spiritual elixir of life, so that it can advance into the future. There are two forces, the embalming of the Egyptians and the disembalming, that modern humanity must still learn. Modern humanity urgently needs to learn to disembalm its rigidified, dead soul forces. This is a particularly important task, since what otherwise appears are such phenomena as those I discussed here recently. Someone like Spengler notices that things aren't working with these embalmed concepts, that embalmed concepts lead to the death of culture. I showed in an article entitled Das Goetheanum what happened in Spengler's case. He did indeed notice that all concepts are dead, but his own concepts are dead as well. What happened to him was like what happened to the woman in the Old Testament who turned to look behind her. Spengler looked behind him at everything that exists as dead, mummified concepts and was thus turned into a pillar of salt. This is just as lifeless. It was the same for Spengler as for Lot's wife. He rigidified into a pillar of salt because his concepts are no more alive than the others. There is an occult saying that wisdom lives in salt, but only when it is dissolved in human mercury and human phosphorus. Spengler did have the wisdom that is solidified in salt, but lacked the mercury that can bring this salt into motion and thereby make it universal and cosmic. And he lacked phosphorus even more. For if one reads Spengler with feeling, particularly with artistic feeling, his concepts cannot kindle anything. I mean kindle anything at a soul level through enthusiasm. They all remain salty and stiff with a sour taste. And afterward one has to suffuse oneself thoroughly with mercury and phosphorus if one is to digest this block of salt called, title, The Decline of the Occident. We must get away from salt, from rigidification. We must apply an elixir of life to our soul mummy, to our system of abstract thoughts. This is what is essential for us to do. The end of Lecture 7.